Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Jimson and Roscoe show. Without Roscoe, he's still on that train to Hereford. It's been a week now and he's fucking still on it. But yeah, today I'm joined by a longtime good friend of mine, Michael Jenkins, or in a past life, Lodos.
Lodos.
but yeah, Michael Jenkins.
Yes, yes. Blessed, man. Blessed for having me, man. It's good to be here, you know, sit down with some real ones, you know, reflect and chat. And I love what you're doing with the podcast and just keeping it moving, Jimson, you know, and that's what you've got to do. Keep creating, innit?
Exactly. Keep making things, man. Because me and you had we went out the other night, wasn't it? And it's what we said then. It's about persistent, just fucking persistence. Showing up.
Showing up, man. Consistency.
Yeah.
That's what half of it is, man. Talent is obviously great, but what you'll notice is like a lot of people get places because they show up and they're consistent, innit? Mm. And then they learn and they get the talent as they're doing it.
You know, like when you listen to those the success stories. And I remember listening to The Undertaker on Joe Rogan. Mm. And The Undertaker was saying like he was ready to quit. So he went and spent all his money on the fucking like this school of like to learn wrestling. He said it was like ropey as fuck, but like he could have went pro basketball, but he wasn't good enough to be pro in the NBA. So he would have ended up in Europe playing for like one of the European teams or something. He's like, nah. So he ended up, and he turned up to this like wrestling place day after day after day after day after day. They wouldn't let him in, wouldn't let him in, wouldn't let him in. And like finally he said it was like after a year he's living in his car, do you know what I mean? And he said like the last day he was about to say fuck this. On the last day, as the guy goes, right, you in the ring. Boom, do you mean? But it's always them ones, you always hear them, like they're living in the car, they're going through, and it's like in that last day they're like ready to quit and they still show up and it's
yeah, you know what I mean? Then magic, then that's when the magic happens,
yeah,
right, you know?
We always start with three good things that's happened to you today.
Three good things that's happened to me today.
Yeah.
Oh boy, well I started the day, took the dog for a walk, so that was good, got out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Took my ute to the dentist and he's all good.
Yeah,
so that was nice, great. Yeah, and I'm here, man.
I'm here, man.
Chatting with you, man, on
Love
the Jimson and Roscoe show.
Love
so
that.
It's all good, like, you know.
Yeah, sick. So for the people that don't know, you are filmmaker. Would you class yourself as?
I mean, I more so class myself now as a sort of writer, director, stroke producer.
Yeah.
But I mean, essentially a filmmaker because, like, yeah, I shoot, I write, I edit, you know, and I can put it out. So it's like, I can do all of it, but I think in more recent years, I've just been finding more of a specific role, like, you know, role that I feel like that's where I want to be, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I suppose it's like anything, though, isn't it? When you start something, you try all the roles, like, do you mean, like, making music, for example?
Trust me, brother.
You're the engineer, you know? You're the writer, do you mean? It's like, well, which one of these is my strongest point? What do I want to do, like, do you mean?
Because
it's not sustainable to fucking do all of them. I mean, you have to start with
to get that name going. And I suppose, I mean, with music it's probably a little bit different because you probably don't need as many people involved in the creation of something, you know. But I think when it comes to like filmmaking or making short films, you know, making music videos, like, you know, it's definitely the collaboration is definitely a lot more of a collaboration, you know. And I thrive off that, you know, just like, you know, back in the YMP days, like, you know, it's just all collaboration coming together just to try and make something, you know.
Yeah.
And then put it out, more importantly, put it out. And that's what like set us apart really at the beginning, was because we just wanted to put things out, innit? And the birth of YouTube and all that encouraged us to like gotta make visuals. You have to make visuals, like, you know. And that was
because there was an interesting thing I was looking at over there, and they were saying about artwork, some music artwork, CD artwork. They're like, the future of CD artwork is going to be like what Spotify did now with their canvases. And they go, future CD artwork or music artwork will be short, like 8-second loop videos. And that will be your artwork for your music. For your cover for the track will be a little video.
And it makes sense, you know, because that's where it's going. Everything is going. I mean, I sort of caught on to this years ago, man. And I was like, because I mean, I was watching my pops make training videos, like, you know? And he was using, so that's how I first sort of got familiar with a camera and got just saw the sort of making of something, like, you know. And that was my dad doing his training to teach his students. And I think, and then growing up, you know, I had a bit of a problem with school because it was like I could always learn, my sort of learning style was definitely more visual, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was like, so I was frustrated with school, and obviously I thought, well, you know, they could have done this, they could have done that. So, you know, that was the whole sort of birth of like getting into filmmaking, and it was a slow sort of it wasn't slow, I guess, it was just a journey, innit? It's like you go from making music. I started off making beats and then making music and writing lyrics and then bringing people together and putting things out, and then I just slowly found the sort of way I wanted to express my art, I guess, you know, because I think the lyrics is great, but you know, a picture says 1,000 words.
Yeah, you're right. It's like I used this the other day, the example of like, for example, short form text on like on social media or anything. The words can be such a powerful thing, but words can be misconstrued in so many ways without the body language or the picture or whatever. You know, it's like
big time.
And they say the people read the text in the mood that they're in.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than the mood of the person who's writing it. You know what I mean? But yeah,
well, that's why that's why we're in this like toxic sort of culture right now, where everything is like everything online is these spaces online are just, you know, places that, you know, nuance is lost. Do you know what I'm saying? And that's a big issue. That's a big issue for human interaction going forward. But it's never going to go back to how it once was. As we, you know, the metaverse is coming, isn't it?
Exactly. I think it just needs to evolve in a way that. But if something's lost, I think we need to gain something elsewhere to make up for it. Because, I don't know, I don't want to be in a robotic, senseless... I mean, we've seen it in films for, like, over the years, haven't we? Like, Equilibrium, 1984, which was actually the birth of Equilibrium, wasn't it? It's basically the same, but...
Like, version. Well, that was the first film
like
that.
The drugs that they were taking, like, do you mean, to fucking numb them and shit, do you know what I mean? It's, it's scary, but I also think it's quite exciting.
Man, it's exciting, man. And I mean, you know, we can be, I don't know, it is scary because, you know, change is scary, innit, I guess. But at the same time, yeah, I'm excited for the future because I am essentially optimistic.
Yeah, and I think you have to be, because if you haven't got any optimism, what's the one that you might as well just fucking kill yourself, innit? It's like, if you haven't got any optimism.
Exactly.
But they say, what's it, it's the trick of learning to be rational. Optimistic, because blind optimism is fucking
that's dangerous,
just as dangerous as fucking. But yeah, to be able to like rationally question things without fucking losing your head, innit? So what about, so going back, like you were saying about your dad making it, because I know that you must have had like a good upbringing in the sense that the values and that were instilled into you, because you were like, I remember from back when we were making music YMP days, I even said this on the episode we done with Mark the other week, because you come up on that, like when we're talking through the history and whatnot. And I kind of referred to you as almost like a local Akala, in a sense of like where you were like...
That's deep, bro.
Like how you were a lot deeper than the rest of us at that young age. It took me into my adult years to discover things on a journey of... which started off with things like Zeitgeist and whatnot. And then you start to realize actually there's awakening, this world is not... as we perceive it, I feel.
But
you, I feel you were on that from fucking early. Like you were always ahead of the game with like with some of your lyrics and what you were even talking about back then.
Yeah, man. I mean, it was...
Is that your dad?
It's a mixture of different things, you know? It's like, it's definitely like my pops. You know, I grew up on a staple diet of like, you know, rebel music, you know, reggae, you know, dub, but also, you know, music from every era. And like, I don't know, I guess I think from a young age, I was into things like, I was into reading. I was into reading a lot, like, you know, and obviously I always had questions when I was a kid. I was always questioning everything. And, you know, racism, I think, is a big sort of factor in what made me start looking at the world from a really young age. Like, why do you see me like that? I mean, the first time I got told to go back to where I came from, I must have been about 7 or something like that, but I remember it vividly. And I thought they were talking about go back to Bristol. That's what I thought they were talking about. Like, you know? It wasn't until I got a bit older when I realised what they were actually talking about, go back to Africa, or, and then hearing the racist language, and I'm just like, well, where does this come from? What is this all about? Why is this the way it is? Like, you know. So I went on a journey from young, and I think reading the Malcolm X biography and my dad showing me the Malcolm X film by Spike Lee, I think that was like, that was probably a bit like my zeitgeist.
Yeah.
But I was about 11, 12, so it was kind of like, so I was always had issues with the way they were teaching things in school. From a young age, I was calling people out, like, you know, so I was getting internally suspended all the time. And it was, but I think that's probably the genesis of like, I suppose it's just you're always questioning yourself. So from young, I've always been questioning myself and then the world around me, and, yeah, and I've always been heavily into reading, like, you know, and that's probably comes from my nan, because she used to make me read the Bible, like, you know.
Yeah.
So I read the Bible front to back, like, you know, because. But I enjoyed reading and the stories, you know what I'm saying? And I enjoyed storytelling and,
yeah,
yeah, learning, basically.
I think the Bible is a powerful tool. And I mean, religion gets its bad rap, but I think there's so much to be said in any religious fucking manuscript. Do you take the good from it? Like, do you mean?
Mm.
Okay, there might not be, some of the mystical stories might be a bit like, well, what am I supposed to do with that type thing? But if you take the moral code that any religion is trying to instill, do you mean? I recently just read the book by Reza Aslan. Mm. You know, the guy, he's the American guy, he's Muslim guy, but he was always on CNN or Fox News fucking arguing with him about when they was like saying about like the female circumcision as a Muslim. He goes, well, no, he goes, that's an issue in, I can't remember what African country it was, but he was like, that's an issue in that country.
Yeah.
That's not an issue
more
in Islam.
Cultural,
that's a cultural thing of that too. Area. He goes, you're not, you can't just say that is, he goes, because that doesn't happen elsewhere. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that guy, but he's like a sick religious scholar. So he wrote Jesus and Nazareth, the life and times of Jesus and Nazareth. And what he'd done, he took like all the historical teachings, like or like, sorry, historical documents of the time of all the people in it. And then he took the Bible stories and he kind of cross-referenced everything. And like basically to sum the whole thing up, it was Jesus and Nazareth is just as much interesting as Jesus Christ. The story they had, he was like a devout Jew, like he, like, because James the Just, who was, James hasn't got that many readings in the Bible, has he? So that's Jesus' brother. But he was saying like Paul, who wasn't actually a disciple, most of the Bible was written from Paul,
yeah,
and Paul wasn't actually one of the main disciples. He's like, James was like a devout, like Jew, like Jewish law was come before everything, whilst he also teaching the teachings of Jesus. And he's like the zealot, like he was going through, it's like the Jewish temple, like revolting against him because they weren't looking after the poor and shit. He was like the real man.
Yeah,
he goes, it's fucking every bit as interesting and radical.
It's deep.
As the mythical man.
And even understanding that when I was at a young age, reading those stories and then having a bit of a nuanced view of it, because, you know, my dad wasn't really religious, so he was telling me the opposite. And obviously he used to teach Jeet Kune Do, so I grew up on, I had a very strong Roman Catholic sort of upbringing from my nan's side and my mum's side, but my dad was anti that, and he taught essentially like Taoism, essentially like, you know, like things around, you know, the yin yang because he was into the sort of very, he was into Eastern philosophy that, you know, come from, you know, the martial arts he was teaching Bruce Lee, the Jeet Kune Do, he was. So he taught me that philosophy.
Yeah.
I learned that philosophy as I was learning, you know, about everything else. And I think now when I look back on it, obviously I had that stage where I was like anti all of these religions things. And you go through that stage. But I think growing up, having kids, going through life, you understand how, some people need a manual in life, like, you know. And essentially that's essentially how the Muslims view it as well. A lot of Muslims that I speak to, they see it as like it's a manual for life, like, you know. It's stories, and I think stories are so powerful. It's the oldest form of communication, you know, sitting around that campfire telling stories, exploding people's minds into different worlds. That's what these religious texts do. And I think if you can take things that can work within your life, then you can. But the problem is people take certain aspects of it and use it for their own nefarious things, like, you know?
Yeah, it's like, I suppose it's like no matter what you look at in it, it's like a lot of people will look at things and they'll look at things already whoever have something in their brain. They're just, they're not looking at things with an open mind. They're looking at things to validate their point that they already have, type thing. I mean, like when someone goes somewhere, it's like they're asking for an opinion, but they're not really asking for an opinion. Someone to like confirm what they're already saying.
Confirm their bias already. And that is, you know, that's a big issue. That's a lot of the dialogue right now, especially on sort of certain online forums and things like that. And it's not good.
Nah.
But how do you, I think it's just trying to stay focused with your message, but again, your message is not locked in. It changes, it evolves, fluid. It adapts, it's fluid.
Yeah.
Fluid like water, man.
Do you feel you've become more conservative since having kids?
Have I become more conservative?
Not like as in the government, but like in your stance and views on life, so to speak.
I don't know. I think probably, yeah. Because you start Yeah, definitely. Mm. Because as you grow up, you start understanding certain things that's going on that you don't necessarily agree with. Yeah. Or, you know, certain things that have changed, which have then left, you know, holes and gaps in people's knowledge or people's understanding. Or yeah, I mean, it's yeah.
Because I feel I have.
Yeah.
I feel like prior to having kids, I would have been more radical in like my approach to, no, like, let people fucking do whatever they want, whenever they want, kind of like fucking, where now I'm more like, well, actually, we do need some sort of structure to be, to have freedom within in the first place. Otherwise, do you mean it's like,
which is what we've got. We've got a structure. Obviously, people keep talking about, you know, free our rights and freedom and that, but we get all these rights and all these freedoms from a specific structure.
Yeah.
You know, and that is like, so if you want to challenge, so if you want to change certain things, you have to challenge the structure. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, no, I agree. You definitely, as you grow up and you have kids and you have more responsibilities, you definitely get more conservative. I don't know if I like the word conservative.
No, I do, because of the negative connotations as well, and you start thinking like, but like, I mean, like, because it doesn't even have to be like in the sense we have like, just like, because you could say conservative on morals and values taken from any system you want. Because there was, I can't remember the guy's name, he's American guy, but he was like around like, and he said he met Malcolm X a couple of times. He was on that sort of scene around that time. I can't remember the dude's name. He was speaking to Russell Brown, and he said one of the fascinating things what he found about Malcolm X was, he said what he witnessed when he found Islam was, it was the first place that he seen people say that they were Muslim first. So like, they wouldn't say I'm white, I'm British, I'm American, and then they'd say the Muslim part would always come first. So it'd be like, I'm Muslim and I'm this and I'm that, like whatever people choose to identify themselves as or whatever. But he said the thing that Malcolm X like loved was that when you go into the mosque, there is no like caste system or fucking anything. It's like, you're Muslim and you're part of that. And he said that was like, it was like, it was really interesting because I hadn't heard that before, but it was like to say, oh, okay, so everyone under this religion, if you're under this religion, there is no caste system, there is no, you are all one in it. And like, to prove that that can happen.
Yeah.
Like,
I think that's definitely true. And that's definitely echoes his experience of when he actually took his Hajj and traveled the world and realized, you know, this thing's deeper than just skin color, but that is the thing that he's dealing with in America.
Yeah.
But, there's definitely like, there's hierarchies in everything, bruv. So like, the religion, every religion has got hierarchies. You know, in Muslim, Sunni, Shia, there's divisions, there's class structures within that.
Yeah.
Just the same with Christianity. It's the way that it's being manipulated to control populations, cultures. You know, first with the sword, because that's how a lot of people got these religions, and then, you know, with the book.
Yeah.
Followed by the book, do you know what I'm saying? Whatever book that is. But I think each religion has, there's depth to each religion. Do you know what I mean? And, and I've always been fascinated by those sorts of things, you know, that's something that's always fascinated me and something I enjoy reading about.
Cause I was listening to John Barnes the other day as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And his footballer. Yeah. Yeah. And like, he was, I think he's just written a book on it, but like, when he was talking, I was like, oh wow. Cause he really like delved into the class side of things. And he was saying about, to get the white working class who is, they don't feel they're privileged. They feel they've got fuck all because they're living in a council house, and it's like, when they're trying to use like football players who are like rich as the issue of white privilege. It's like, someone in that scenario isn't going to understand that.
No,
they're going to be like, what do you mean fucking privilege? He's fucking jetting off to Ibiza. He's fucking in a much position than me.
Yeah.
It's like,
The language is a language. It's definitely a language thing. There's something there, but it's, I think that language of privilege, I think is probably something we need to dissect a bit more, because of course, in, you know, regardless of what race you are, there's class structures in all races. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There's certain, you go to Nigeria, there's hierarchies, you know? Jordan Peterson says that that's how we, you know, we've always organized.
The lobster.
I thought that was quite funny. Like, you know, I thought that was quite funny. I don't know how sort of true that is or just how, but you know, I think, when it comes to like these hierarchies and like things around racism and things like that, the conversation just needs to make sure we keep the nuance in the conversation.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the time, you know, these conversations just become binary, become black and white.
Yeah.
And it's so
and
much
not,
deeper than that. And
well,
so
that's,
much deeper
that's why this conversation was so interesting, because he was saying like, we need to get to a point. He goes, equality sounds great.
Mm,
he goes, but equality, it's like, you're not. If you're more smarter than someone and you're an expert in your field of neuroscience, for example, like you're a neurologist, you are going to look, not look down, but you're going to, you know, you're going to be, you're going to feel more of a human being than the person, not more of a human being, what's the word I'm looking for? You know what I mean? Like you're going to feel
more accomplished, maybe.
Yeah, no, than the person who may be a trainee or an intern.
Yeah. Of course.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he says, what we need to get at is not for fucking trivial things like sex, race. These shouldn't be things that we should be looking at each other unequally on.
Mm.
This is where we need to get to. He goes, you can sort out the rest of it at a later date, but he goes, you're always going to be looking at people in different ways. Then not everyone is going to be equal, because people are different. You might have strengths here, weaknesses here, so you're going to look at people and he goes, but the argument is to, when you take the class aside, like to look at someone within that same say you're both working class, there shouldn't be difference between the race, sex or whatever. And it was really interesting to he eloquently put it. Do you know what I mean? It was like, where again, like you say, like a lot of the nuances are lost when it's someone just like saying, this is this. And it's just like, fucking.
Yeah. And that's it. And that becomes the conversation. Do you know what I mean? And that becomes, I think, you know, if you look at, I think the footballers have definitely, I think with the whole world, the Euros and that, what happened. And the way that, you know, obviously, if you're a black person watching the Euros, you know, like, you better not miss them goals.
Yeah.
You know already, you know, you innately know that what's going to happen. You know what I'm saying? So, but for some people, it came as a shock.
Mm.
And I feel like that is an issue, because it's not a shock for black people.
Mm.
So why is that? Why doesn't everybody have the same understanding of what's going on here?
Mm.
And it's, you know, people have got, it's different interests, isn't it? Different interested parties are doing certain things, you know, and a lot of things are tokenism. I think when it comes to equality, I mean, it's ridiculous to say that, well, you know, everybody's equal. Like,
yeah.
Because that's just,
it's
common,
not
man. That's not, we're not in some communist, we're not in some, you know, dictator regime like that. Not everybody's not equal on the same level, you know, everybody's on different levels at different stages and different things. So I think, again, it's just the nuances. We just can't forget that is like relevant, like, you know, to everybody, like, you know, and everybody's circumstances should be used to inform how we move forward. When it comes to institutions, though, I think this is where, because there's been historic institutional issues when it comes to the way, because obviously institutions are made up of individual people, but it's all about leadership and how that has come about and how it hasn't changed since it started. Because a lot of institutions don't really change the way that they move. That's why everything's so slow, slow to change. I think the institutions that we have in this country, definitely we need to look at them and look at how we can address some of the imbalances there. But I'd say that we've got to have a more, it starts from the top. Like, and if you look at the government, you know, the parliament, and that's a really good sort of example, like shows you like where we are. Look at the leadership we've got in this country. Look at the way this whole pandemic's been, the communication of this pandemic has been done. It's like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just like, and that is the examples of, but there isn't hardly any working class people in those rooms. And that's a problem. Like, you know, because then they're not really talking to us.
Well, it was something that, when you said about the token thing, then it was something that John Barnes said as well, which I thought was interesting. He said, when people then who make noise stand up, rally and are outspoken about these things for a good cause, but then they usually get snapped up by these institutions and go, okay, you can come and represent whatever it is you're representing within the institution.
Yeah.
He goes, you've then got to toe the line because you are now then a part of the institution.
Mm.
So everything you were fighting for before, you can kind of say that, but you can't say that anymore. Mm. And if you do, you'll then be kicked from the institution. So it's like, you mean they're going to make your life nice and they're going to make it easy for you, but the people that you were there and using your voice for are no better off, because now you've just become another cog in it. And he said that is also something which is pretty tricky, isn't it? Because again, like you said, these institutions, they're fucking age-old institutions.
Exactly. I mean,
it's the, when we had Jinx on, we had an interesting talk about it as well, and he was saying, like, look, his view was people need to be more realistic about how long change is going to take.
Yeah.
Definitely. You can't just change things overnight, he goes, and that's the trouble what I think people need to get to grips with. It's like, you can't just be like, right, fuck that, we'll tour this up and tear that up. It's like, no, it's got...
Yeah, it takes generations, man. I mean, people, you know, in power, they have plans. They don't have plans for 5, 10 years. They have plans for 50 years. So if you want to reverse things, this is how long it's going to take. You need to... Yeah, I think that is... Yeah, people don't understand how quick change can happen. Yeah. It can take long, or it can be quick. It just depends on how you do it.
Yeah.
And if you look at, you know... Some places they use the gun for change, and that's it. And that makes change.
And that
wins wars, and that's the change right there.
It's the trouble is in those scenarios, though. It's the fucking aftermath, which is usually more messy than the gun violence. I mean, the fucking the breakdowns of society afterwards. Because the trouble with breaking down a society is this, there's so many things, like the supply chains and everything, what people, what we take for granted. And I was talking to Brendan about it the other week, and he was talking about, for example, how fragile our water system is. And it's like, you take out the water system, he goes, fucking, do you mean? And I was down in Cornwall in the summer.
Yeah.
And a farmer dug down and he fucking hit a pipe, right? And the fucking, there was no running water from Newquay all the way down to fucking like Land's End. Like, I mean, like half of Cornwall, fucking no running water.
Very bad infrastructure.
Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. The woman come over, like, who was on our campsite, and she said to us, she goes, girl, like, told us that happened. She's like, go and get some water. So, of course, went like, fucking, went to the first shop. People gone in there, all the water's gone. Went to Aldi, managed to get some, just got a couple of, like, big gallons. But it took, like, 3 days for them to get it back on.
Wow.
But, like, say you was in a blitz or something, or, like, do you mean there was some, like, fucking warfare going? It's like, right, cut that off.
I mean,
we can survive for food for quite long, but without fresh water, it's like...
Exactly, like, you know, and that is, we don't understand how fragile this society is, like, you know, and that's something, and I think the pandemic maybe showed people that, I don't know, maybe
I think so,
opened people's eyes to it, like, because remember, where are you going to get your fresh water from?
Yeah, I remember before that when they were talking about important jobs or non-essential jobs or jobs that, like, do you mean, they were, I can't remember what the argument or the wording was that they were arguing about, but they were basically like saying, like, demeaning job or non-skilled, that was what they were saying, non-skilled. They were classing people as like delivery drivers, supermarket workers, and all these people as like unskilled workers. But then you look in the pandemic, they were the ones that were like keeping shit moving.
Kept the country going.
Do you know what I mean? And it was the ones that, like, these skilled workers, I don't know, say, like, you worked on finances or whatever, it's like, yeah, you stay home.
Yeah. Exactly. So it tells you, so it should tell you what's really, that should be a revelation for everybody as far as, like, how we view these people that do these frontline jobs, like, you know, like NHS, security, delivery drivers, bus drivers, you know, it's crazy, man. And I made a poem about that's when, during the pandemic is when I've picked up the pen again for a little bit, and that's, you know, I've made a whole thing about, you know, these frontline workers, and a lot of them are migrants, you know, and how important and overlooked that they have been since the 50s or whatever, since after the war, like, you know, and it's a shame. It shames the country, you know, and that's how I feel. It is definitely a big shame. But again, people from the top, that's not the messaging they want to get out.
I feel as well, though, as a lot of them from the top, I feel it's, whilst there are some which are insidious and they're like very demeaning in everything that they do, majority of people, they've just come to a point where they're so detached. Do you know what I mean? Because it's like, even like, because I know we can't all go through life thinking about every issue that's going on everywhere, because you'd just be a fucking nervous wreck and you wouldn't leave the house. And it's like, oh, fuck, something's happened over there. Do you know what I mean? You're fucking right in there. I could catch this disease and I could go there, so better not do that. And it's like, oh, fuck, they're being bombed in Syria. Like, fucking, do you mean it's like your head would be like,
phew. Yeah. And that's how a lot of people's heads are, because of social media. Yeah. It's just,
do you mean,
quick access.
Picking it up. But it's like, I think if you also, on this other thing, if you're completely unaware of that, you're in the same thing. You could, like, also be in a bubble, and it's like, fucking, do you know what I mean? It's like, you could then be less empathetic towards people. Do you know what I mean? It's like you like not seeing it because you're so wrapped in your own head or your own life or your own bubble that you're not actually like taking the time to think, hang on a minute. Because I spoke something the other day about like the amount of people that slip through the cracks. Like at the moment, they're talking about like mental health crisis and whatnot.
Yeah.
It's like, but for so long, the amount of people that with like that have been struggling from mental health are usually ones that slip through the cracks.
Yeah.
Because if you really are struggling, like they're not usually ones to push things. Mm. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
and yeah, they might not get help. They might not. Yeah.
And you have to push it because these like I've noticed my missus mum at the moment, she's like really been struggling. It's like they've been really struggling. It's because her mum won't push it. And like, do you mean it's like they've been going through some shit? But it's like, if you're on your own or whatever, and you're not pushing, and you're pushing, and it's like ringing, it's like, no, I need to see someone. For example, at the moment with the doctors, so doctors not doing the face-to-face thing, yeah, and it's like, you're not going to see it. If you are a little bit introverted, or a little bit timid, or a bit nervous, and you're like,
you're going to toe the line on that, and just
I can't have an appointment, and you're just going to sit in your eyes and make yourself worse by panicking, do you know what I mean? Because you're not, and you may not have the children, brothers, sisters, parents, whatever, who can help you and be like, look,
yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's definitely a real thing, man. And it's like, yeah, the pandemic has really, you know, shown the how vulnerable people are, like, you know, and with disinformation and not knowing, and then, yeah, like not going to the doctors, like, you know, because you think, like, yeah, I managed to see the doctor during the pandemic because I kept on to them, but I know most people wouldn't do that.
No, they would not do that. Like, so I mean, it's like, just step back. It's frightening.
It is frightening, like, you know, and I feel like it's good to have conversations about it. And I noticed that's what you've been doing a lot with your podcast, is talking about, because man, them don't talk about these things, really. Mm. They don't talk about these things. And this is a big issue, like, you know. And I've been in lots of different conversations, forums, meetings, where, you know, people are talking about male mental health and how, like, how important it is for us to keep in check with ourselves, you know what I'm saying? And that is, but obviously when you're in the rat race and, you know, you've got responsibilities, you've got this to look after, you've got that, you've got, you know, rent to pay and all them things there, it's like, where do you find the time to do that work? Because you do need to do that work, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's definitely, you know, we just need to keep talking about it and making it less stigmatized, you know, less like...
I also think, like, just generally conversation in general, away from being online, because
definitely.
I remember when me and you spoke the other week when we met up and we spoke about if you don't have conversations in the real world. So I'm more on the side of distrust from institutions, and I'm going to distrust what the government and what these kind of places are telling me. So natural, like when it comes to the VAX fucking situation and shit, like I'm on the side of things where it's like, well, hang on a minute, I'm skeptical. Big pharma and big tech. It's like, do you know what I mean? And especially when it benefits all of them, you're thinking, hang on a minute, alarm bells are ringing here.
Big alarm bells.
Do you know what I mean? But for like, I then witnessed other people, and I know that you witnessed as well. It's like some people going down like rabbit holes of like real extreme fucking conspiracy views of it. Like fucking,
yeah, man.
Do you know what I mean? Like some like, whoa, you've like, you can just tell like, and you got to sympathize. It's like some people haven't like been able to go out and have like conversations with people from different political spectrums, different views. Because in the real world, people can disagree and they don't. They're not at each other's throats, like fucking. Do you know what I mean? Like online, it's like like you said, like we said, it can be very toxic. But in the real world, when you start hearing different political views, you can then recheck some of your own writers. Yeah. It's like, okay, and you start to see some things, and it's like, okay, maybe I still don't agree with that, but maybe what you said there about that, I kind of like. Do you know what I mean? Your mind can be swayed, and it's like, okay, maybe.
Yeah.
So you mean, so like, definitely, before you know it, you think you're being fucking microchipped with like, or whatever. Do you know what I mean? It's like, jeez. Do you know what I mean? It's like, see, people can be there, and their thoughts can be unchecked, and they can really go down a rabbit hole. And you can see,
and keep going, but there's no end to that.
Exactly.
There's no end to that, and that is really,
especially if the same people, because the trouble with the algorithms is they're going to feed you the people that are on the same shit.
Yeah.
If you, and then all of a sudden it's like, and it's like, it magnifies and you become in this echo chamber. And
that's
then,
why you have to cut that shit off.
Yeah. Everyone's shouting the same thing. Yeah. It's like, oh, fuck. Like, do you mean? And it's like, whoa, you need to like go and listen or talk to some people from.
Get out.
Yeah.
Get away from that screen, man.
Yeah.
Turn off that internet. I mean, it's, I think that's going to be a big sort of, over the next 10, 20 years, that's going to be a big thing. is like making sure you're escaping the internet.
Yes, like screen time.
Everything is on the internet now. Almost everything. Mm. In a minute, it will be everything. Like, you know,
yeah,
where you won't be able to do anything without interacting with the screen.
Yeah,
and it's kind of like, yeah, we've just got to know how to check ourselves when things are like, you know, and that's really important. And as you said earlier, language online can get lost. People that understand the nuances within what you're saying can get lost. So that's why it's important, because I think, what is it, 78% of our communication is through body language.
Body language, like, you know, so tone of voice.
It's like there's so many different other factors. So it is important to, like, yeah, turn off the internet and turn off these social media platforms, because they are just giving you an echo chamber. And in the reality, when you step outside your yard, the world's not an echo chamber like that.
You know, I remember Brendan was saying to me the other week when I went and met him for a coffee, he said he's come off Facebook.
Mm.
And he said he was like on Facebook, and he said he goes until he come off and you start like speaking real world. He goes, he thought there was like this massive war going on between like the vax and the unvax, and he's like, there's not. reality, like, do you know what I mean?
It's just people chatting loads of stuff online.
Yeah.
And then people staying online because of the dopamine hitting or whatever it's giving you. Yeah. Like, you know, it's like that. And that is like, it's toxic. I mean, that's what these companies want you to do. They don't want you to leave the app, innit? So that's the incentive for them. They don't want you to leave that. They need your eyes on it as long as possible. But for us, we need our eyes, you know, looking at the sky or whatever, looking at a human being, like, you know?
Yeah, because I've done recently, like, I go through waves of using YouTube, and my YouTube recommendations are very much on, like, well, you could guess the kind of shit that YouTube throws at me, the type of shit that I want to watch. And it can leave me very in a dark place. YouTube can leave me like, wow, like,
and that's deep, human.
And I know that, and I know I have to delete the app for periods of time and go back on. But I get a lot of my inspiration for writing from being in these places and putting myself in these places and listening to these things and reading these things.
Yeah.
But recently I've got like a lot more into, like, because I read for 20 minutes a day in the morning. It's a part of my morning routine. I make sure I read for 20 minutes. And with that, you can kind of do it more objectively, because you put the book down and you're reading the words and you can take your time with it. But YouTube, I find it puts me in this dark place, and I'm aware of that. And I use that as a lot of my tool for writing, so I can, like, any fears I may have as a human being that where we may be heading, I can amplify them by tuning into these things, writing it, creating something artistic out of it, and then fucking stepping back,
dipping, like, in and dipping out.
Do you know what I mean? It's like almost therapeutic to, like, give my worries of where society and that is going, like, in a dark space, by putting that out, but also amplifying it by taking it in and then letting it go. Do you know what I mean? It's
definitely during this pandemic, I think it was probably the first time I was like, I'm gonna quit social media for a little bit. And then just things just started going crazy for me as far as like the opportunities and starting up a new company. So really, I've been going flat out for like 20 months, like flat out basically. And this is like a good first time break where it's like a couple of weeks and I can just reset. But yeah, man, I mean, I think with that YouTube thing and that algorithm, I mean, it's interesting because I was watching a lot of like self-help, like motivational videos and things like that. And they're not in the algorithm.
Nah.
It's very interesting, you know?
Someone was saying to me the other day, they said, Facebook people thought, oh yeah, they've given them the option to do the angry face and all that sort of
shit.
And Facebook algorithm actually shows you more of what you give an angry face for, because it triggers you more and keeps you on for longer. So people like showing the things they dislike actually receive more of the shit they dislike, because it's what triggers them and keeps them on longer.
That's messed up, man, and that is gonna mess with us. But I think, is it gonna affect our youths the same? This is the difference.
Because it's different if you're born into it, isn't it?
You're born into it. So are you going to, you know, is it going to affect the utes? I don't know if your ute plays Fortnite or anything.
No, he's still a bit young. He's on Minecraft.
Well, that's basically...
It's like the stepping stone. Fortnite.
But that's like, they're going to be fully familiar with this whole metaverse. And they're going to be there. They know it. It's like the screen is not going to be an issue.
Because I suppose you look at it, it's like... I mean, saying that, some of the older generation are now also getting hooked on fucking Facebook or whatnot.
Yeah.
But like... because our era is like secondary school. We were through the transition, innit?
Yeah.
First half of secondary school, you didn't really have it. Then like middle of secondary school, you had like your Nokia 4210 with your snake and your text messaging.
Yeah.
And then we were there like through MySpace, Bebo, and we like lived through it. Mm. Where like the generation after was kind of like, no, they already had those things in place.
Yeah, they had it.
So now the generation after that, which is our kids, will have even more, like you say, with the metaverse and fucking.
They have it. They won't.
Do you know what I mean?
They won't really
Alexa
deal with cash.
In like all these households. Alexa fucking petrifies me.
Yeah.
Absolutely petrifies me.
I turn off, make sure all them things are turned off. But eventually, we will succumb to it, bruv.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Because the technology would get so good and we'll feel so secure with it.
Yeah.
And that's all they're working on. And that's, and for the youngers, for the youths, it would just be standard. It would be like, what, you've got
Alexa? Nature.
It's just like, what are you talking about?
It's like, I remember Chris C. Double, he said to me once, he said, this is years ago when he first said this, and he goes, imagine getting your like fucking great-great-granddad, putting him in the passenger seat of your car whilst you're on the fucking phone to like mobile phone talking to him with music blaring. Like, do you know what I mean? They're going to be like, fucking, what the fuck? Do you mean?
What's going on? Like,
just shy quickly it goes. So like, we talk about Metaverse and Neuralink and it's like, it's not far away. Was it next year, the Neuralink, the first humans having it? Is it the 2022?
Is that what you're saying? Yeah. I mean, it could already been being done, bro. I mean, the technology is there. It's all there, innit? But they're just giving us little drips and drabs, but we know what's happening, innit? Because, you know, we can create things in our mind and then that is how we work, innit? We can think something up and then create it.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of our existence. But at the same time, that could be a bit of a curse because, like, you know?
I said it in a lyric the other day. It was, it's like, it's not unexpected. We're all Hollywood prepped. Do you know what I mean? It's like fucking.
Yep.
We're all Hollywood prepped, mate. Like,
all Hollywood preps. And my generation, I mean, I grew up, we grew up on Hollywood, on these films, like, you know, the 90s. We grew up on these films, man. They were there, innit? The advent of DVDs. And we saw all this. And it's a different interaction. I bought my youth's first CD the other week, like, you know, Dave album, like, you know. And that's the first time he's actually opened up the booklet, read it.
Yeah. Seen,
you know what I'm saying? I'm thinking, wow, man, that's like, that's deep.
Like that, I used to love that. Like,
that was
where was
it
recorded? Who produced it?
Yeah,
like,
do
you mean
like
fucking, Because I know, like, it's not even just like in every genre, like, you listen to like all the old rock heads or the old fucking any genre, they all say the same thing. It's like, oh, I miss the artwork, I miss reading it and getting this product in my hand.
But the kids don't really have that, they don't see it as a product like that anymore.
Nah.
It's not physical, I guess. It's not physical.
And I mean,
I
can't lie, having Apple Music on my phone is fucking so convenient.
Yeah.
Like, I've got the world of music on my finger. And then, saying here, like, it's like a system over there. So, like, even though I have, like, all this music at my fingertips, I still kind of listen to, like, similar sort of things. And it's like, I don't.
Yeah.
I know, like, the modern generation are, like, they're a lot more throwaway.
Yeah.
And they like to, like, song next, and on to the next. Where I'm still like, oh, I still kind of listen to an album on there, but like, the power of just being able to have that in my pocket, rather than back in the day, like when you're in the car and you're like, fucking, where's the CD wallet? Like, you know, keep going, not that one.
Yeah.
And you got, like, you know, when you got like burnt CDs and it's like, fucking, I don't know, like Home Mix, like 7 or some shit.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no, it must be on 8. Like, really trying to like flick through the fucking CDs.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Man. It's physical, isn't it? It's very much, it's there, it's tangible.
Yeah.
I do like that, but I think the next generation are not going to care about that.
Nah, man, NFTs.
NFTs, like, you can buy, you know, buying suits on Fortnite, buying dances on Fortnite. Yeah. I mean, I didn't get it.
Hanging a JPEG in your fucking metaverse house, like, do you know what I mean?
In your Minecraft house, hanging a JPEG. Yeah, man, I mean, it's going to make sense to them.
Yeah.
It's going to make full sense.
And if you think, like, in this world, they can have, like, they'll have mansions.
Yeah.
Even though it's not real tangible in this world and you're not living in, like, do you know what I mean? Like, they put a headset on, they're there.
Yeah.
They're in paradise.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, and if you're born into that, it's because I was watching this thing on the Illuminati the other day, and it was the best documentary on the Illuminati I've ever seen. And it was like the Adam fucking whatever his face was, the guy, like, and it was like, it was away from the whole conspiracy side of it and what they achieved to do and how they overtook from the Freemasons and what they wanted to infiltrate and how they wanted to control. And it was like how it passed down through societies rather than the economic shit and that they were trying to achieve and how they were trying to overthrow the Catholic Church from rule and like create this basically what the world is basically is now.
Yeah.
Corporation shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you know what I mean? It's like, again, like you look over generations, it's like, yeah, that shit fucking takes time to fucking like everything in it. I'll send you the link to it afterwards, because it was a really good one. But let's go on to like, so it's Black Wave, that's Because you're doing 8th Sense Media, or is it just Black Wave?
Yeah, so 8th Sense Media was the first production company I started. It's probably about 10 years ago this year, man. And that was just more about, that was just me being a, you know, filmmaker.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Right, like pitching ideas, winning commissions, making them, doing the whole process.
Would you say that one of your first big ones was the Stop and Search one that you did?
I think that was the first one that really got me recognition from the industry as far as like, because obviously it was a bit, you know, it was a bit deep, innit? Obviously making a film, getting commissioned by the police to make a film.
And then getting fucking stopped outside by the same police station.
Do you know what I mean? So it was perfect because it as far as storytelling, it emphasised my point. It emphasised the point as far as like black males being, I think it was 7 times more likely to be stopped and searched at that time.
Mm.
And yeah, it just proved the point. Like even somebody that's working for the police to make them a documentary, I'm still seen as suspicious. And I had a big argument with the police about that. Luckily there's certain people within the force that were on my side, so luckily it went through. But because of that, yeah, that's when I think I started getting more industry recognition as far as like that I'm just somebody that's here to do this, isn't it? But I think the thing that sparked me thinking about doing like media properly was making a music video television. That was that was, and obviously doing that with C-Dubs, which was, because C's been a massive influence on like that direction, wanting to even venture into that path or seeing that path as an option. I think definitely having
he's so creative, man.
Like,
to go back earlier, I forgot to mention when we were talking about when you were saying about the all the moving parts that go into filmmaking, and me working with C for so long, and C's just like fucking don't need that, do this, and he'll just fucking do it, like out of like. He's so creative.
He's a don.
I went as an extra in a film with Antonio. Do you know Antonio? Antonio Burstaff. He's been in like a few quite like big films recently.
Okay.
Like. But he's a Portuguese guy from Bath. I trained jiu-jitsu with him, but he's like, he's doing really well. And I was an extra, and he was like the lead role in this jiu-jitsu movie.
Okay, sick.
So he got like a load of the people that he knew to come in and be extra.
Wicked.
He's teaching the school. But like being on set for that, and being on set for a C-Dubs shoot, it was like worlds apart. Like, C-Dubs was like, yep, come on, do it, boom, boom, stand over there. Yeah. Over there, they were like, nope, right, putting smoke in the room to like dampen the light in and like moving everything around. Yeah. And they were like filming on, is it 38 mil or whatever it is?
Okay,
the fucking, it was like expensive.
On film,
like, London Film School it was.
Okay.
So it was all like fucking, they had the whole, and I was like, wow. I was like, this is boring, man.
Yeah, and that's like, and that's the difference.
Just waiting around.
Yeah, like, that's what it is. I mean, it is long, long days, man. I mean, and that is the difference between doing it more of a, I mean, people would call it more of a guerrilla style filmmaking.
Yeah,
where you're just doing your thing, basically. But then, you know, so I had to learn. So I grew up on that guerrilla style filming because I didn't go to film school or college or anything like that. Because I dropped out of all them things there, trying to do music.
Trial and error, innit?
Trial and error, like, you know. But YouTube was my university, basically.
Yeah.
Learning how to like to make films and use the camera. And obviously see, just given being that inspiration. But I think, yeah, learning that step from doing those sort of guerrilla type filmmaking to actually, you know, doing a set and doing it more, a bit more established, a bit more. And I guess that just depends on you getting funding, like how much funding you can get, like basically that's what it is, like, you know. And I learned that when I started doing short films for Channel 4, Random Acts, and that's when I really had like a set and really started looking at all the different roles and finding people that could do different roles in it, and learning that process of producing. So it is a whole different thing, and it is long days.
So did you were you like hiring in people, or were like some of them you were filling with people that you've just seen qualities in?
Yeah. It's one of those things, isn't it? If you know someone that's good at editing, you bring them in. A camera person, someone wants to do camera, someone that's interested in sound, bring them in. I mean, that is how you do it. And obviously, I suppose not going to film school meant that I didn't really have that much of a network. So I've had to learn how to network and put myself out there so I can know people and be known, innit? And that is like, that's half of it as well, showing
who you know, innit?
Who you know. I mean, that's unfortunate about that game, is like, it's all about who you know. It doesn't matter how good you are, you've got to know the right people, and people can trust you to deliver. Because now that I'm doing stuff with, like, you know, brands and you know, I'm trying to step up again, it's just, you're realizing like the levels to it, like, you know, and all the different people that you need to have involved. Like, I had to get, when we started Black Wave, we had to get a health and safety advisor. I'd never heard about one of them people before in my life.
So it's your liability if you're doing proper shoots.
Yeah, you have to have that. And it's like, it's just a fee that you have to pay. But no one told me that you have to do that, but that's something that you have to do. So it's like, just little, you know, learning the ropes. And that's what, I mean, it's just been a journey. Like, you know, setting up Black Wave with Mina was just a way of, like, trying to do it independently, because I guess, like, looking at the structure, and I've known this from a long time, because I used to hate the media. I used to, like, custom, in all my raps, I used to be cussing the media out, and it's like, but then at one point I thought, well, do I want to just be moaning about it, or do I want to try and do something to change these images that I'm seeing? Do you know what I'm saying? So I thought, in fact, I'm going to just do something to change it. But still understanding that, like, going to go get a job at the BBC, I don't know. I mean, it's great for, like, me, for learning, for understanding how certain things work, but I guess it's just not me. So really I wanted to set up Black Wave so that we could do productions independently. And obviously at the time, just looking at, you know, the political discourse and the vibration at the moment, everybody's talking about diversity this, diversity that, but then there's no diverse companies. And it's like, well, so we're just having, so everyone's just waffling, basically.
Yeah.
So I was just like, right, let's make it. Let's make the company. And we done it. And then the frigging pandemic hit. So our first production with the BBC was going to be, it was a film marking the 40th anniversary of the St. Paul's riots. And, and those riots, like, you know, changed the country, basically. That all got cancelled because we were filming with elders. And obviously at that point, no one really knew what this thing was.
Was that... going to be just documentary, or are you going to have, like, reenactments and stuff like that?
That was just going to be a straight documentary, looking at some of those people, bringing some people from that time back together 40 years later. They haven't seen each other for 40 years. That's what that was going to be, but that got cancelled. So, yeah, starting a business and then the pandemic hitting, that was quite deep, because it was like, okay. But, like, everybody was like, well, what's going to happen? Nobody knows, innit? And then, I think just as that was happening... the BBC put out something, they want a commission's Culture in Quarantine, it was called. So yeah, we submitted for that and we got that, which was great. Like, you know, that was like, okay, we can work, we can still work. And that's when I did a perm. That's when I picked up the pen again. But then after that, the whole Black Lives Matter march happened, and I filmed that years ago when it happened in Bristol. So when I heard that it was happening again, I was like, yeah, I got to go and just film this. And obviously it is a pandemic, but this is important, because we've just witnessed a lynching, and I want to see how. So when I went to the march, it was obviously there was a march that happened a few days before the big one. That was only maybe about 300 people. That was wicked, great energy. Then the next one happened, and I've never been in a situation like that, like where I'm seeing all these different people marching on a black issue. It was felt so, like, it was so euphoric. It was weird because we weren't supposed to be out. Everyone had masks on, but there was 10, but the whole street was rammed, like, you know. And I'd been making a I'd been following the people, like a group of people called Counter in Colston, that had been challenging the city on different things around Colston for years. For about 5 years I've been following them. So yeah, when that happened, I thought to myself, well, imagine if that happens, that wouldn't happen. Went down there.
And it happened.
And I was just like, wow, it was crazy. It was a crazy moment. What was even more crazy, one moment that always sticks out to me is that it was so, I think we'd done the part where everybody basically had a moment of silence for the 8 minutes that it took for George Floyd to die.
Yeah.
That was crazy because it was complete silence around the statue. I was right next to it, complete silence, everybody around silence, but there's 10,000 people everywhere. So you can see, it was such a weird, trippy moment. Like, you know, it was complete, like, it was really quiet in this one space here, but there was 10,000 people on the street. So there was noise in the background, and it was a strange time. But obviously after that happened, and because I was there filming it, things just blew up, like, you know, as far as like, I got a commission from Channel 4, which was our first commission, which went like on after the news. So it was like a prime time slot, like, you know, and it was, so that was great. Like, you know, and then, yeah, we've just been building and building, you know, the whole of 2020 was just building, and 2021, again, we've just been catching up with ourselves because the pandemic happened and we weren't quite ready to get fully into it, but we had to be ready, innit? We had to just do it. So yeah, man, it's been a hectic time. So I'm kind of like thankful that I'm still here, and like I'm still sort of mentally sound, and like I'm ready for like the next few years ahead, like where we want to switch up.
So Pickney, well, that's the last thing you've done, right?
Pickney was ongoing. Yeah, it's been ongoing. I started writing that probably 2018, I think, or 19. Mm. Started writing that. The whole application process was long, but obviously all application processes are long, yeah, especially when you're doing it for the first time. And that was the first time where I was like, well, I didn't normally like apply to bodies to get funding to make films. Mm. I just basically went out and made it.
Whoa. This camera will be all right, though, won't it?
Yeah. The mics will be off, though.
The mics will be off.
Technical difficulties!
Yeah, man. Good chat, bro.
Yeah.
But yeah, the mental health thing, bro, is just, it's serious, bro. It's serious, yeah, man. It's definitely over this period is where, when I really started to have to look at mental health and, like, yeah, I need to cut off social media.
Yeah, I think that I know that even Instagram are like, whether they're doing it for a token gesture or not is a different thing. But I know that they're like putting out a lot of shit about having screen breaks and giving people more power to block people. And
okay, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's important, man.
Yeah. Costa! I know. Ben!
Yeah, the camera will be rolling with the fucking. So what? So these guys, do they do this thing? Is it standard? Like,
nah. So it's like Roscoe's friends with Costa, and like Costa done.
Oh shit!
We've lost all power. It's just gone off.
Just cut out.
Literally just switched that.
Can you speak into the mics?
1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2.
Nothing's coming up.
Yeah. So that means the mixer would have gone. The camera will still be rolling.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's been 57 minutes. Where's that gone from there?
Is anything tripped in the house?
No, don't go check now.
I mean, the camera will still pick us up, so I could kind of wrap it up and just bump the sound up on the camera.
Yeah, it's recording nothing on here, though.
You're probably going to need lights, though, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, shit. Dark, innit?
Quite soon, we can do it.
Yeah.
Do it that style, horror style.
Gorilla style.
Gorilla style, bro. Trust me, bro. This is a proper setup.
Yeah, gorilla style. So, camera, I'm just going to fucking leave this and edit it like I do with that style. But,
this is good, man. I love this.
Yeah, so we got to, Pickney.
Pickney. Pickney was the first film that I've written and directed. It took about a good 2 years to write it, funded by the BFI, which is great. We shot it during lockdown. We shot it in October 2020, a week before the second lockdown, the one that happened just before Christmas. That was madness because I wanted to have a big funeral party and I couldn't do it because of the restrictions and stuff like that. So I had to get like a family and bring a family together so they could actually stay to like be together
in
because
a bubble,
It was crazy, man. It was like, yeah, making films during this pandemic has just added another layer of bullshit, basically.
Because when I shot the Gun Height music video in like the height of the pandemic, and because that was guerrilla style, it was just like, fuck it, right, come on. And we like done it in like some abandoned fucking place, and it was just proper row. But like, yeah, in times like that, I'm thankful for like, yeah, fucking, we just do our thing. Like, there's no like, fucking, I'm not following any health and safety or nothing. It's just like,
Where
you, for example, in that, like, you've got
to
like,
I've got to do it. I've got to do it now because it's proper now. It's like, I can get sued and all that stuff. So I've got to be careful, which is cool because I want to, eventually, I always wanted to do it properly. Like,
yeah.
And I feel like, and it's had such a wicked reception. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm. It's just been crazy.
HBO quarterfinalist?
Yeah, HBO quarterfinalist, which was just mad. I thought like to myself, how's that going to happen? It's mad how the traction is received in America.
Yeah.
It's just received a lot of traction over there compared to here. So it's kind of like,
is that out for people to watch now? They can go and watch that now?
Not yet. It's still doing the festival runs.
Yeah.
It's got another festival it's going to be in February in America, but I can't talk about it right now, which is pretty shitty. But and then eventually, I don't know, I put it on Prime or something, I don't know, I'll put it somewhere where you can access it. But yeah, it taught me a lot. It's basically a real learning step as far as like writing and directing something. It's won a Nicola Award in America, which is great, which basically just helps me then go on to the next thing, you know. But I think feature film features and having like a product like a feature film or series, that is the next, that's definitely the next step, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I definitely want to do something that is in tow with, like, you know, British traditions of filmmaking, and I want to do something really different, something unexpected, you know what I'm saying? So that's what I'm working on next year, and we'll just see what happens, man, but making films is not a get-rich thing.
Nah, so do you feel that your future is predominantly within the black issues and race issues and stuff, and you think that's where Black Wave will always go and be a voice for?
Yeah, I think it's definitely going to be a voice for as long as it needs to be. I mean, yeah, obviously black issues and that are definitely at the heart of what we do, but we just want to tell stories, man. We want to tell different stories, you know what I'm saying? Obviously it was started because of the lack of different faces on TV. So if we can try and change that, not just on TV, but behind the scenes making the TV, that's really important. But it doesn't really matter. The subject matter doesn't really matter. As far as, like, as long as this, like, fits with our values and fits with, you know, our core sort of values and what we want to try and do and put out into the world, you know? Because there's loads of different places where you can get... That's the beauty of it. There's so many different places you can get content. All different types of content for all your little niche things, which is great. And that is, like, so we feel like we're in it at the right time. Like, we set this up at the right time, especially locally in this part of the country, you know. It's an entity that people need to have there. But I think the next step is, and the challenge to all these other organizations that say that they need this sort of organization there, is just put your money where your mouth is. And step up, I guess. I'm done with the waffle, man. I'm done with the chat. I just like to do things. Let's just get things done, man.
Action,
man. That's what.
Did they say knowledge is only power when acted? When it's used? When you use it, like
what's the point about
knowledge if you don't implement it?
That's very important, like, you know. So we're just trying to build that and build a bit of an institution. I think that's that's what we're trying to do with the boat that we're trying to create, like, you know, an art space basically. In the middle of Bristol city centre, in the harbour, but it's a unique space where people can understand that troubled history that Bristol has with reconciling its history. Just even acknowledging it properly, you know, that's something that's an issue. But I think we're just trying to build some sort of an institution, and I feel like that's what people. If we want to change things, then we've got to build structure. You know? And I feel like that's really important. So I think that's what I want to do, just build structure going forward, man. Whether that's through Black Wave, whether that's through, you know, another company that I might set up, which is a different structure. You know, for VR, who knows, like, you know, because there's so many different ways of storytelling, and I'm sort of open to all of these different ways. You know, obviously I love the traditional way of storytelling, but definitely embracing, you know, AR and VR into my practice. You know, that's definitely something I want to do.
It's adapt or die, innit? It's like you look at that old thing, like when Blockbusters had the chance to buy Netflix, and they're like, nah, never take off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Now, like, it's beating Hollywood. It's challenging Hollywood.
Yeah. You know? That film what you were talking about, Ben, the other day, when you're talking about the Leonardo DiCaprio one. Because when that trailer came on Netflix yesterday, when I was sat there with my missus, I was like, fucking hell, that's a Netflix original film. The cast that they got in it, it's like Leonardo DiCaprio, Ariana Grande. Fucking hell, that's A-list class for a Netflix original film. Normally it's like independent, and they've got like, you're talking Hollywood fucking stars.
Yeah, and I like it, and I don't like it, because it's like, I still love that independence.
Yeah.
Like, they still got, hopefully they won't never lose that, but.
Yeah.
So I do, it's like, hopefully they never lose that, because that independent thing is important.
I know they still love that, because it was the thing with Dave Chappelle.
Like, yeah.
They had all the protests, like, take the new one off. Yeah. And they're like, do you know how much fucking money I just pay for that? They ain't fucking taking it off.
Yeah, man, you've got to listen and learn and take it in. A lot of people are mad about that. I didn't watch the whole thing.
They need to take the sound bites. Like, we spoke about this the other night with me, man. Yeah. It's like, Kanye West is a prime example. He's the perfect person to take a soundbite from, because he's such a lateral thinker.
Yeah.
And he'll jump from one thing to the other. Yeah. And you've kind of got to listen to the whole thing before he comes back to the point he was initially making, because he'll go way off that way before he comes back to that way. And it's like, unless you listen to it all, it's like, fucking, whoa, take that, boom, put that in there. And then everyone's like, what the fuck? Like, you mean everyone loses their shit?
Exactly.
I mean, it's, Yeah, I guess that's why politicians are so fucking trained not to do that, innit?
Yeah.
Where it's like they constantly never answering a question because they know that that fucking soundbite's going to come. That's why Corbyn was such fucking a prime example, because he was an easy soundbiteable guy because he actually went off. Bernie Sanders, any of these kind of people that kind of go off the norm of the fucking...
Trump,
best example of all.
People love Trump. They still need Trump. They still need that, which is really bad, like, you know, the way the media dealt with that. Because, he said some silly things, but he also said things which were interesting and different.
Yeah.
Different language to the politician.
Yeah.
Obviously, he said some things which are stupid which he shouldn't have been saying as the president, as the leader of the free world. Do you know what I mean? That was very irresponsible. But at the same time, he done his politics a little bit different, and I sort of kind of rate that a little bit. That is different, and that should teach everybody that, like, that should be a teachable moment of, like,
with people, the normal isn't working.
Yeah.
So I've recently read a book called The Marshmallow Test, and it was the book, the science, you know, have you ever heard of The Marshmallow Test? So what I hear, they give a marshmallow to kids. They say, you can have this one marshmallow now. You've got to wait 20 minutes. And this is like preschool age children. So they give them one marshmallow, or they got to wait, and they can have two later on. And over the years, it's adapted into different things. And then they sit there and they film and they watch how the children distract themselves and what children are better off equipped with self-distraction or delayed gratification. And in there, he was talking about how people can be so conscientious and like really like they can do all these things and then do something stupid like Bill Clinton, like get a blowjob under the table. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then people are like, oh, he's an idiot. It's like, well, he's not an idiot because, like, look at all the other things that he's had to be that conscientious in and that, like, on point with before he to get where he is. He goes, but then in certain situations, the hot part of the brain can take over.
Yeah.
And it's like with anyone, some people got the hot part of the brain takes over more than other parts of the brain. But, like, for someone like that, if you took all of their issues and all of that person and put it on a scale, that person would still be very fucking conscientious and goal-driven and high-performing.
Yeah.
But it's only the one scandalous, like, oh, I can't believe why he would do it. Yeah. It's like, well...
Yeah, it's sensational. It's the way it's sensationalised, isn't it? So, not good, man. But I love the way that basically you turn this into a guerrilla filmmaking and responded straight away.
C-Double, you'd be proud.
Yeah, man. Big up C-Dubs, man. Yeah.
To wrap up, we always ask, what's your personal meaning of life? It might change. Mine changes.
Jesus, what's my personal meaning? I think one thing that I've had in my head for the whole year is I used to say balance quite a lot. Like, it's all about balance, trying to find balance. But I've sort of gone away from that and just really sort of seen it as like, you need to find the harmony because you're never going to, it's always going to be out of balance.
Yeah.
You just need to try and figure out a way of making it all more harmonious. So yeah, definitely finding the harmony in life. That's definitely something that is that's in my mind at the moment.
Harmony, man. Yeah,
let's wrap it there. Respect for having me on, bro.
Yeah, man, we'll have to get you back on when Ross goes on as well, because like there's still more like I wanted to go into
bro, we can chat for hours when we go back, bro, so we can chat.
Do it again. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Jenkins.
Hey, man, bless up.
Yeah, button's up in there, man.
Right, I think it's tripped inside.
Stuff is tripped inside?
Yeah.